Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Laurie. Welcome to the show, Laurie, and thank you for making time for us today. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So we had your son on the show months ago, Nathan Ross. And I have to say, what an incredible guy. I really... hats off to you, you know, hats off to Nathan. He's a great guy. It's well worth checking out that episode, listeners. And so when I reached out to you and you said that you'd like to come onto the podcast, I was really delighted because I'd love to hear more about you. So could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please, Laurie?
Sure. I am Laurie Ross. I live in a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri in the United States, and I am a longtime foster adoptive mom. My husband and I started fostering in 1985 and fostered over 400 kids in the years following that. We ended up having five birth children and adopting 23 children, mostly from the foster care system during that time. One of them was my son, Nathan. I also am a founder and the CEO of an organization that provides supports and services to families in Missouri and Kansas that provide foster care for kids and have adopted kids out of foster care and for kids in the foster care system in multiple different ways. And have been doing that about 22 years now.
Wow. Wow. What an experience. What a great episode we're in for here. To tap into that wisdom and modesty, I'm sure. I was talking to somebody about this the other week and they said, "Oh no, it's just the truth." I said, "Oh, how's the modesty going?" You know. So when you hear this phrase, thriving adoptees, what comes to your mind, Laurie?
I'll go to Nathan and think about Nathan as an example of a thriving adoptee. Many people say what you said, hats off to you, as if there is something special that my husband or I did with Nathan. And the reality is that we parented Nathan just like anyone else would have potentially parented Nathan. And that Nathan internally is a young man who was remarkable to his core, probably from the day he was born. Didn't have diddly squat to do with Randy and I. We were given the gift of a young man named Nathan, and we were able to realize that gift and parent him through some teenage years and into adulthood. And so that, I think, is what I would say I think of when I think of thriving adoptees. It is the fact that we recognize the value of each and every child that we have an opportunity to impact either in foster care or via adoption, and that we do our best to be that parent for those children in the moments that we have them in our lives, and help them realize the best version they can be of themselves. Help them recognize that they are whole and absolutely good and perfect human beings in whatever form they came into this earth in. So
you use the word realize there a couple of times. What does so the thing that I've heard about, you know, I love the word realize, and people say to me, you know, I've heard this word, you know, seeing the world with real eyes, as in like seeing things clearly. What does realization mean to you, Laurie?
I do think it's realize. I think it is recognizing the truth of what's in front of us. Often often we are looking at a situation and the totality of the situation, or we're seeing behaviors and the after effect of something someone's experienced, or we're looking at the, you know, the less than ideal circumstances that someone came from, and we associate the value of that human being with whatever it is that we're seeing in front of us in that moment. And the truth is that the core value of that human being is good and perfect in and of itself already. Their circumstances and their experiences absolutely determine a lot about how they will experience the world. But I don't fix a broken child. That's not my job. I don't think my children are broken. I can't, for that matter, fix a broken system. I can do my best every day to love and guide and nurture and push and shove and do what I can do within the context of that to help each child be who they are and who they were meant to be in this world.
Yeah. When you say that you don't think that they're broken, does that mean that you don't think they're wounded as well?
Like, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, I know they're wounded. And honestly, so are the adults that are interacting with them. Not just the ones they came from, the foster caregivers, the adoptive parents. We all walk around as wounded people on this earth. Things happen that hurt us. And absolutely, the kids that come into our homes are wounded, deeply wounded often. But that does not diminish who they are.
Okay. So, fascinating. Because it's all about the it's all about the distinctions for me on this. So, if I may ask one, really, because I think you and I might have a different definition of wounded. I think we might do. So, what do you see as the difference between wounded and broken then?
A broken toy is one that you throw away. you know, a broken car is one that goes to the junkyard. Broken means it's not good anymore. In my mind, wounded is completely different. Cracks heal, wounds heal. And actually, oftentimes are the things that strengthen us and give us our character and make us who we become as human beings. I know that I have been wounded multiple times in my life, and I don't know that at my ripe old age of 57, I would go back and change that, because it is who I am now. Those things color who I am as a human being. And if I'm going to value myself, I have to value those opportunities for learning.
Yeah. Do the kids see themselves as broken?
I think sometimes they do. I really do think sometimes they do. I think sometimes they do. And I think sometimes as adults, we contribute to that by villainizing the parents they came from, by imposing our whatever our biases are on their circumstances. I think kids oftentimes feel like there is something inherently wrong with them that caused them to deserve this kind of a life or a situation that their peers at school didn't have wrong with them.
Yeah.
And it's horribly sad.
Yeah. How do we help them see the truth?
I think we have to do our work as adults. we have to be better people for them. we have to look at ourselves and acknowledge where we fall down and fail, and we have to pick ourselves back up, and we can't dump our garbage onto our kids. And it's important how we approach kids as we're trying to help them heal. It's important that we hear them, that we truly see them, that we're able to give them space and nurturing at the same time, that we allow them to feel what they need to feel in the moment and work their way through that, and that we recognize their resilience as a key piece of who they are as human beings. So somebody once said to me that we can cast a positive future vision for them. And I think there's a benefit to that. I mean, I think we need to see the good in our kids and be able to, instead of constantly saying things that indicate to a child, you know, if you keep acting like that, it's only going to get you in, you know, this bad place or that bad place, that we're able to instead help them imagine the world looking differently than it sees sometimes from their wounded place, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we have to do work on ourselves. One of the things that I think is a big problem in foster caring and in adoption is that we don't do enough work really with parents who want to take on this challenge. This isn't, you know, your grandma's parenting. This is serious hard work sometimes. And we haven't done enough work with parents in helping them resolve their own issues before they begin to try to work with kids. Classic example are parents who adopt and are afraid of their kids' reconnections with their birth families, or feel rejected by their kids wanting to reconnect with their birth families. And I don't think we do nearly enough work on that issue. And now in the age of the internet, there's no such thing as closed adoption anymore. Kids will know who they are and where they came from. And we have to be, as grown people who love these kids, secure in our role in their lives and guides and helpers for them as they begin to reconnect and interact with their birth families. We can't protect them from who they are. We need to appreciate who they are and be glad to help them reconnect to that in a way that will help them know themselves and be able to continue on their path.
Yeah. So we did a great episode on this. People, listeners might like to check out by a lady called Holly Ann Petrie. And she, the podcast is called Unpacking Our Own Baggage as Adoptive Parents. Yeah. And this was looking at that area. And it's an area that I think I'm totally in agreement with you on this, that this is the richest seam to mine. And I do that from a perspective as not as a husband, you know, a husband and a son. I'm not a dad. Me and my wife haven't got a kid. But I know that I can impact me. It's about who I'm being, and I don't get it right. I often get it wrong. I can't affect my wife, but I can affect who I'm being, and who I'm being means the need for more work. So I'm totally with you on that. And I'm just wondering, you've mentioned the adopted parents being afraid of reconnection as a potential sign, a warning flag that they need to do some more work, that they have a blind spot, a spot that to which they are blind, you know, an insight that they haven't yet had. What are the warning signs or blind spot? You know, what are the blind spots do you see in adoptive parents to the need that when you see them, they're like a red flag to you that this parent needs to do a little bit more work on themselves, or a lot more work on themselves?
So some others are pretty obvious around issues of race and identity in your kids. If you haven't done a significant amount of work on those issues, and this is an area where I haven't done nearly enough myself, you can create some major problems for yourself and your children moving forward. Issues around LGBTQ identity development. I think sometimes I'm going to just be honest that I live in the Midwest in what we refer to as the Bible Belt. And oftentimes when I hear adoptive parents espousing too much kind of evangelical Christianity as a basis for saving the orphans and fathering the fatherless and those kinds of things, that gives me a significant amount of concern. Not because I don't believe there's room for faith in what all of us do in parenting kids, but because sometimes there is a blindness that comes with that faith that doesn't allow you to meet your kids where they are, or doesn't allow you to have the flexibility in terms of your thought and your parenting that is necessary to learn with your kids as you're parenting them. So those are red flags for me where I feel like we need to dig in a whole lot more.
What do you mean by flexibility, Lauren?
Oh, if you've been raised in a spare the rod, spoil the child philosophy of life, or you, I just was reading a story in USA Today yesterday about a situation in Florida. A religious family had adopted a child internationally and believed the child was demon possessed and ended up beating the child to death. And so there's just some inflexibility in thought there, rather than recognizing a child in trauma and behaviors related to that trauma. Your mind goes to some biblical belief system that doesn't allow you the opportunity to really reach out for and access the kinds of education and help that you need to be able to effectively meet that child's needs. So I'm always worried about that sort of black and white thinking, because parenting in general is a lot of gray, and parenting kids who've come from traumatic backgrounds is even more. So,
yeah, that's a horrific story to hear. I'm an example guy. I'm not great on theory. Is there something that you could, perhaps a less extreme example that pops into your mind that you've seen, that you've come?
Sure. Another family that I'm aware of had placement of two siblings in the home, and older child was acting out behaviors, doing some lying and some aggressive acting out behavior, and the family decided that the influence of the older child on the younger child and their other children in the home was too detrimental, that the older child had too significant of needs to stay, based on that family's basically that child was too broken and was going to drag the rest of the family down a negative path. And so that they were championing the older child go elsewhere, away from their sibling and out of the pre-adopt home. And that's an example that I see on a pretty regular basis. And in that circumstance, the family is being counseled and goes back to their church and their church community, which which jumps to, you know, that child is too damaged. That child needs to be somewhere else. You're going to ruin the younger child by keeping the older child with that child. And how can we grow the younger child up in our Christian correct home without,
wow,
you know, at me, it's those kinds of things that they're just big red flags for me, because the thinking is very black and white. And these are deep issues.
Yeah.
These are deep issues. And you don't replace, you know, you don't replace someone's sibling. You don't replace them, and you don't replace their birth parents. They are who they are. And so if you can't fully accept and understand who they are, then are you good for them? Or would they maybe have been better off living in a marginally appropriate family? I mean, that's another area that I struggle personally, is we take too many kids away. You know, there's a lot of people, at least in the United States, that are brought into foster care for issues related to substance abuse and poverty that really aren't abuse. You know, it's the category of neglect. And we bring these children out of homes where they are loved and they're provided for at the level they can be provided for. And rather than helping those families to provide better, we remove their children. And I mean, I think that's part of American capitalism, honestly, is that we've done a terrible job of recognizing that every human being deserves a basic standard of life. I don't know what it's going to take to move our country in that direction, but it would change child welfare tremendously if we took a few steps.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about, kid, you know, everybody's value, and broken and wounded, and helping kids see this stuff. How do we get, I've done a lot of work in elementary schools, right, about helping kids understand their emotions and this sort of thing. And so I'm fascinated by this. I'm fascinated by this area of empowering kids. I think, you know, you've talked about parents doing their own work. And I'm 100% of that. And I hear a lot of kind of like, I don't hear a lot of people talking about empowering the kids and helping kids see their own value. I don't hear a lot about, like, I see lots of trauma training, but no ways to help kids understand trauma. Understand, you know, because, like, if we empower them to understand it, then they're gonna, you know, like, we should be trauma informed and hope obsessed. But we should help our kids see that they are not their trauma. They are not their past. They're not their trauma. Their value is infinite and unaffected by what's happened to them. So I know kind of like how I do that in a one-to-one coaching session with a kid, or in an elementary school with a group of kids. But what's your take on all this? How do we empower kids to see their value? Not capital value, their perfection. Let me use perfection, because that's you mentioned capitalism, so I don't want to say value as in pound signs. I mean their perfection, their wholeness, their unbrokenness.
So it's probably easier for you to do in a one-on-one setting or in a coaching kind of relationship than it is for a parent to do on a day-to-day basis. But I will say, because as the parent, you have to maintain order and set the rules and get people where they're supposed to be and, you know, make sure homework gets done and do all of that work in addition to helping them recognize their value. But I'm going to again go back to it falls on the parent to be able to recognize that at the core of every issue is the fact that that child needs to understand their own value. So I have a child who's 15 who has a diagnosis of, well, she's not got the official diagnosis, but a working diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. Most definitely predisposed to that based on the genetics of her birth parents. It's a tough set of behaviors to interact with and live with on a daily basis in a setting in your home. I don't know how much you know about it or your listeners know about it, but people with borderline personality disorder do a push-pull dance constantly. They want attention, they crave attention, they're looking for attention, and then they are also angry and push you away. They will seek attention in negative, in scary and dangerous and inappropriate ways sometimes. And then, and then they will, crave to be loved and nurtured and protected right when you're angry at them because they've just done all this negative, angry stuff. So it's tough. It's a tough thing to parent a child that has those issues and then continue to recognize that underneath all of that is that core value of a human being. And I think it's most tough for my daughter who has this issue to see that she herself is a valuable human being. So for me, the biggest piece as a parent is that I am able to regulate my own emotions and that I'm not taking those behaviors personally. And that when I'm talking to my daughter, that I'm able to draw her back always to the value that she holds as a human being. So I will not be there to stand on her shoulder and tell her how to interact with people as she goes out into the world. I can't spare her necessarily from pain she may endure if she demonstrates some of these behaviors with a boyfriend down the road or, you know, in a work environment. I can't fix those things from her, but I can remind her on a daily basis of the fact that she is a good, valuable human being and that she deserves to be loved and cared for and does not deserve to be the victim of other people's abusive behavior or treatment of her. So it's tough. It's a tough thing to do on a daily basis, but to point out how big her heart is and how much she cares about animals and how I know how much she cares about to see, to recognize all of the ways that the little glimpses of the beauty in her slip out in the way she interacted with her sibling on that one issue yesterday, or the fact that she stepped up and helped the one who was struggling to get the dishes done, actually get the dishes done without, you know, drawing any attention or creating any drama around that. It's a tough thing as a parent to navigate the policeman of the house role with the, yeah. I'm constantly working to build you up so that you can see what I see.
Yeah. So I've heard this talked about as catching them doing something right.
Absolutely.
Rather than and something to do with human brains, we seem to be a lot focused. You know, we're focused on finding. We're not focused on finding the good, are we? We're not. We're looking for what's wrong most of the time. I think I often talk about this, auditors, accountants, they're looking for the wrong number. Lawyers are looking for what's wrong you know, lawyers are looking for what's wrong in the contract. And my own background in educational publishing, I'm looking for what's wrong: the spelling mistake, the apostrophe, the, you know, the incorrect punctuation, and we seem to be predetermined to do that. Sorry. So catching somebody doing something right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the reminder.
It is. And it's hard as a parent because you have to do both, right? You have to catch them doing something wrong so you can change the direction. And you have to catch them doing something right so that you can continue to hold up for them, casting that positive future vision of who you are. This is who you are deep inside. You are not all this drama. You are this good person. And that's what's going to matter as you move forward in life. And it's yours. It's yours to own. It's not mine. It's not dad's. It's yours. You are who you are. And it isn't, you know, we do a nice job, I think, of complimenting our kids, but you don't compliment someone into a sense of self-esteem. They earn self-esteem. Kids earn self-esteem by doing for others. Like, your self-esteem grows as you develop your skills and your interest in doing things for someone outside of yourself. So for my daughter, if she walks the dogs, which she loves to do, and they help her stay regulated, she feels good about having done that with those dogs, and it did something for the family. No one else had to do it. And so it's a win-win. I'm looking always for those win-wins with her. But she can feel good about that. And she can feel good about her ability to interact really beautifully with animals. But I didn't give that to her. She did that herself. She got there herself. So in so many ways, I'm like the director on the play, but the reality is that the kids they're creating their own role, whatever it is. And it's just my job to see it and rise it up.
Yeah. I like you. I like you. I love your clarity on this, that kids earn their self-esteem by helping others. I think they also earn their self-esteem by seeing who they are.
Agreed.
And that, for me, the whole identity piece that you alluded to, you mentioned it in passing earlier on. I think for me, that is the ultimate, and it's it's an experiential thing. So the analogy I often mention when I'm talking about this is the difference between hearing a joke and thinking that's funny and hearing a joke and laughing. So we're looking for the self-esteem to be experienced, not intellectually seen, or, you know, so it's something that happens. Another way of saying that is it's something that happens in the heart or in the body. It's an embodied learning rather than it's something that that's happened as an abstract notion, a nice idea, a fleeting kind of thing.
Right.
And that's got depth, and that has to be experienced. And it's not something that I can, that I can put into a lovely, crisp soundbite on a podcast.
But that's the reality, and the reality is that for my kids, oftentimes it's easier to first do for others before I can feel like I'm a whole person on the inside. So if we can recognize that we have the ability to do something that positively impacts someone else's life first. And we do that by doing something, right? That is a physical thing you can do. Then eventually we can maybe recognize that there is a part of ourselves that is good and worthy and whole on the inside. And that's especially tough for my 15-year-old. And so for her, the doing hopefully leads then to the recognizing.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about experience here.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, learning by doing rather than learning by thinking is some an idea or answering a math quiz or a top 10 things you like about yourself or all these affirmations and all that, looking in the mirror and all that gratitude in and all that kind of intellectual stuff that we seem to have.
Yeah, I've said for years, you can't give someone self-esteem either. No matter what you do, you cannot give someone else self-esteem. I can tell you all day long that you're the most attractive human being I've ever laid eyes on. That is not going to give you self-esteem, because you're going to have your internal thoughts and feelings about that. And my words aren't going to mean squat, doesn't mean anything. In reality, self-esteem is internal. It's inherent in us. And we have to develop that for ourselves.
Yeah.
And the quickest way I've found to help my kids to recognize it is by first helping others.
Yeah.
And feeling the power of being able to do that.
Yeah. Because I guess what's happening with that is we are taking the focus away from, so one of my mentors talks about moving from the me to the we.
Right.
So if we're focusing on the me and we're feeling isolated, we're struggling because of these the past trauma or, you know, this the stuff that we're going through. You talked about the borderline personality disorder. We're struggling, but the labels, we're not thinking that we're getting anywhere. You know, all our focus is on us as the central drama in a nasty soap opera. Whereas if we focus on the we're distracted from our own inner critic, distracted from our own inner critic by focusing on, you know, and you hear a lot about a lot of companies do this stuff, don't they, on that, and like they do employee volunteering. So the adults go down into soup kitchens and help out, and you become part of a cause that's bigger than yourself, and so you get a sense of perspective off that as well.
Right, right.
Have you come across other ways that, because what we're saying really is there's no such thing as secondhand self-esteem. It has to be, there's no such thing. I came up with this about 2 years ago now, talking to a friend of my wife's. I said, oh, there's no such thing as a secondhand epiphany. You know, we have to have them for ourselves, an insight, a sight from within. And I bang on about this quite a lot because a lot of people are kind of focused on strategies, and strategies without any oomph behind them don't get anywhere. Whereas, you know, strategies, oomph first, insight first, strategy lined on top of that, that's more likely to get us somewhere. So have you seen anything else that helps this self-esteem?
Honestly, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't found any other magical ways to get there.
Yeah.
I wish I could say.
Yeah, because the reason it's my preoccupation really is this, because I've done all my work with non-adoptees, right? And none of them think they're good enough either. You know, you said at the top of the conversation that everybody's wounded, yeah? They don't think they're good enough either. And I'm saying like this, and I thought, well, I thought it was just my business stuff. I thought it was my adoption stuff. I thought it was my just my stuff. But nobody thinks they're good enough.
Right.
So, you know, adoptees don't haven't kind of, we think we've cornered the market on the not good enough, the notion of not being good enough. And we've got a really, really compelling, we've got incontrovertible evidence to support our claim that we're not good enough, because we were given away, surrendered, handed over, relinquished, you know, whatever word you, I don't know. So when I talk about this, I was talking, well, just because we've got a really compelling reason to believe it's true doesn't mean it is actually true. And hopefully then you're starting to shake at the foundations of the belief that we're not good enough. And we shake at that. We shake at the foundations, and that's a first step on the journey to self-acceptance, is getting rid of the questioning the belief that we're not good enough first, rather than trying to jump straight into the "you're gorgeous, you're perfect" thing, which, as you say, doesn't work, because we can tell. We say in Yorkshire, we say you can tell me till I'm blue in my face, in blue in the face. You can tell me till the cows come home. It doesn't work. There's no such thing as second identity. So, does that sound like, you know?
You're right on target. I 100% agree with everything you just said.
Yeah.
And it's all of us. And you're right. It is tougher for adoptees because they do have incontrovertible proof, whether it's legitimately incontrovertible proof or not. But the reality is that all of us, myself included, have not been good enough for a good long time. And all of us do that to ourselves. And it's an internal battle that we're working with all the time. Yeah. So it doesn't go away.
So it is then the essence of the work seeing the illegitimacy of our own beliefs?
Absolutely.
And to put that in a funny, slightly more lighthearted way, I heard somebody saying this, a mentor of mine, talking about, he was driving, he's an American guy, he's driving down a freeway, and he had the idea of, you know, how silly he was being, captivated, how enraptured he was by his own silly limiting belief, right? He didn't think it was silly. He used to think it was the truth. He thought, I heard a great one on this. He thought he was listening to CNN, but he realized he was watching the Comedy Channel. And he was driving down a freeway in the States, and he had to pull over onto the hard shoulder. Sorry, I told this story last week on the podcast. Sorry, listeners, but I've started, so I'll finish. So he had to pull over because he was laughing so much at his own fallibility, and, you know, the fact that he'd fallen for his own limiting belief before. And I was actually going down a motorway, which in the UK is equivalent of a freeway, and I had my experience mirrored his. I almost had to pull over as well, but I just slowed down. I just pulled into the slow lane, and it was because it was quiet on a Saturday morning, laughing at my own stuff, laughing at the insanity of the stuff flowing through my head at that time.
Right, we can do it to ourselves, can't we?
Yeah. We're coming up for time, so I'm going to question whether. All right, so I'm just going to put one point. So on that. We sometimes talk about getting in our own way. Okay. And as parents getting, as adults getting, as kids, we're getting in our own way. And I was thinking, well, how is that actually possible? How do we get in? You know, I'm walking down the pavement, what you would call the sidewalk. How can I actually get in my own way? I can't actually get in my way unless there's two people, right? So I haven't got that that stuff going. I'm just one body, right? So what we're actually doing when we say we're getting in our own way, it's more like a dance between the. Have you ever done that when you're walking down a sidewalk and you're trying to avoid somebody coming the other way, and you both feign left and you both go the wrong way? Yeah. So that's getting in somebody else's way. But the, you know, getting in our own way is a thought. It's the inner critic. It's the inner critic that's getting in our way. It's the voice of doom. It's the idiot on the left shoulder or whatever it is. That's what's getting in our way. It's a thought. And it gets in our way until we see it's just a thought. And that's why we do the work to see the thoughts are the Comedy Channel, not CNN.
Yeah, if there was anything I could give my kids, it would be the recognition that what's in their head is really in control of their destiny. If you can begin to recognize that you set the limits for yourself in your head, then you can recognize that you can take those limits off. And rather than getting in your own way, you can be the guide of your future, whatever it might be. And I think some of my kids have found their way there. And I know Nathan is one of those. I hope the rest of them will get there as well. Yeah.
That's a fantastic point to bring it in. I love the crispness and the clarity and the simplicity of that. When I'm listening to podcasts, I often want to rewind. I'm going to urge the listeners to rewind and forget about what Simon just said and go back to what Laurie just said. Because there is gold in them thar hills with what you just said. Thanks a lot, Laurie, and thank you, listeners.
Thank you, Simon.